Let's pray. Dear Father, at the beginning of this year, may we hear your voice. May we hear your voice that welcomes us home, the voice that speaks to our need, the voice of one who knows us and loves us, the voice that challenges us to be your people in the world. Amen. So why Psalm 90? Because I was going to speak on who is Jesus to you, your Jesus. You know, as you do, you start off with the topic. And I had started writing that, and somehow I was flipping through the Bible and saw Psalm 90 and thought, oh, looks like I'm preaching on Psalm 90. So there we are. So, yes, the other one, I've put those notes aside for another day. So this is an old year gone and a new year starting. Many of the themes that come up in this psalm, I felt, are a good place, as the communion has been, to put ourselves as we take a moment to think who we are and what we're doing in this world with our God. The foundation of our faith celebrates a Lord who was put to death and killed for us. But culturally, it's not something we like to think about all that much. Historically, the memento mori, the reminders of death, the fact that we are mortal, were so embedded in society that they were in every picture, in every book, up until the 20th century. Nowadays, our children's books are not supposed to have any scary things in them. They get rewritten. Our Disney films rewrite the old legends and leave out the nasty bits. So we have unsettled feeling about having to consider where our mortality sits. So there are some of the reasons why I thought this might be a good place to start. I've also been reading Ecclesiastes, another cheery book to start my year. All right, so just a little bit about this psalm. I've resisted the temptation to look at all the poetic forms and structures in it, and if anyone's interested, we can have a good old chat over a cup of coffee about those. I have got the notes. So this is a liturgical psalm. It's been designed to be prayed. It's not an information, it's not historical background. It's there for us to go into and to meet our God in the context of this psalm. It's presented through the persona of Moses. Some commentators say they believe it is written by Moses, and some commentators say in the voice of Moses. I've tended to go with the second one, but I'm not at all offended by the first. I can see their reasons for saying so. So Moses experienced both the long and arduous journey from exile to the promised land, and the frustration of his people turning to idols, and the need to accept that he was not going to be the one to take them into the promised land. He knows the holy presence of God. He knows the depths of his people's failure to live faithfully to God. He knows the experience of unfulfilled work and the need to humbly accept his mortality and limitations. So it's his voice that has been chosen to speak to this story of our God and his dealings with us, his people. So this psalm, which was so beautifully written, read, thanks Phil, and the pictures, I thought, what on earth are you going to do with the pictures? But they were great. We have the widest canvas. So I'm going to view this canvas with three questions. Who is God? Who are we? And how should we live? So verses 1 to 6, the psalm begins affirming God both as creator and as our home, our refuge. Lord, you have been our dwelling place or our home throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, that you brought forth the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So this is the foundation of what he has to say, the person of God. This sets up the first of our great contrasts. God is eternal and we are mortal, as fleeting as grass that lives only for a day. Our mortal state has been set in place by God. He's the one who says, "Back to the dust, you guys." We cannot forget that we are temporary dwellers in this world. So verses 3 to 11, who are we? Here we have the second great contrast between God as righteous and us as sinners. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They are not like new grass of the morning. Though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it is dry and withered. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. It's not really what we want to hear. This is one of those Old Testament passages we feel we don't need anymore because we have the good news in Jesus that sets aside our debts and welcomes us in. In her book on responses to climate change, Christiana Figueres speaks of the need to allow ourselves adequate time and space to feel our grief and express it, to sit with the fact that we don't know how to fix it. So sometimes we're so quick to go, God's fixed the problem, here's Jesus, all done, phew, don't have to think about that anymore. But the psalmist invites us to sit and experience the knowledge of our mortality and our failure to be what God has created us to be. It's not a very pleasant place to sit. There are some traditions in Christianity that invite people into that space more deliberately. Some of the Catholic traditions that some people here would be familiar with. Sometimes we look back on those historical times with a sense of horror and think, well, that was a bit awful. Glad we don't do that anymore. And perhaps, you know, we don't want to go back to flagellation and some of the more extreme versions of that. But perhaps time to sit and just not run from it too quickly. Perhaps we need to feel the reality of our human condition, both as mortals and those under judgment for doing wrong. To sit, as the writer of the Ecclesiastes does, before jumping to our comfortable confidence that she'll be right, mate. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, 11 to 12 says, "The race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come." We are described as dust, as dry grass, passing quickly as a dream in the night. This should forestall any arrogance on our part to think that we control our destiny. The third contrast here is between God's anger and our fear on one hand, and at the end, God's compassion and our joy. As we allow ourselves to sit with the realities of our mortality and limitation, the hugeness of God's self and the smallness of our lives can be overwhelming. It's not surprising that the writer fears being obliterated. Here in this psalm, the writer plumbs the depths of our condition before God, who, should he choose to do so, could deal with us as we deserve. The commentary in the New International Version Study Bible introduces this psalm speaking of the writer's neither defiance nor despair, but honest recognition of our mortality and nature. This God, who knows our every thought and action, can, if he chooses, find us wanting and discard us and let us be consumed by his anger. As we contemplate the reality of our situation, our fear or our sober recognition of who we are is the beginning of wisdom. What evidence does the writer have that God views us in this way? Certainly the prophets have warned and pleaded and called to Israel for repentance, but there is always more. In the prophets, there is always the call to return and to be re-established in the relationship. In Ezekiel 34, verse 11, I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. And Psalm 103, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. For he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. So the third question, how should we live? The last contrast is between God, the compassionate giver of love and joy, and us as the recipients, able to ask him for good things, confident in his desire to look favourably upon us. Having stepped into this new space, we are free to ask for what we need. The writer asks that God turn from his wrath and have compassion. This, of course, was always his nature. We are the ones who must turn to know him in his true nature. This is going to be the shortest sermon I've ever given.
Hooray.
The psalm sets up three contrasts. Each of these leaves me with a question. First, the everlasting God and the mortal. Why do we need to be reminded, challenged, have our noses rubbed in our inevitable demise? It's so obvious. So why labour the point? Not going to answer that, by the way. Second, the angry God and the compassionate God. Where did we get that angry God from? And why do we hold on to it? Thirdly, the life of trouble and sorrow and the years of gladness. Do we really step from one to the other? Can we experience such a shift in a fallen world? Can we have joy and gladness in times of trouble and sorrow? The pivotal point in this psalm for me is verse 12. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Failure to let a deep knowledge of our nature and mortality sit within us keeps us striving fruitlessly in the world. We read God as angry because nothing we do will ever be enough. When we number our days aright and seek wisdom, we know God as compassionate, as one who loves us so well that he would lay down his life for us. Then we can offer our work in the world with his blessing. Have a sober estimate of yourself, says Paul. Don't be puffed up in your own estimation. This is not to be less than who we are, but to live fully in a true understanding of ourselves as beloved creatures in God's world. And I'll leave you with a picture. You might have to have a look at it later a bit closer. I remember Rose bringing some pictures one day. I couldn't find the one she brought. He's a man sitting at his desk writing with his skull on the windowsill beside him. So this is a very common image. Even in pictures of a celebration or a wedding or a beautiful scene, there'll always be something tucked there. Don't forget, we're only mortals. Okay, so if you want to look at that, I'll leave it on the table. Thank you. I don't know if that's sort of thing people would have questions about or comments. Perhaps some of you can answer my three questions for me. That would be nice. Can I repeat the questions? Yeah. Why do we have to be reminded of our mortality? Where do we get the angry God from and why do we hang on to him? Do we move from trouble and sorrow to gladness and joy? Or do we have both? It's a bit obvious, but yeah. All right. So has anyone got anything that they want to say on those?
Why do we need to be reminded of our mortality? I'm aware that people in those times were very aware. So they were probably more expressing what they were already aware of, because death was a very common thing, particularly children dying early, people dying of diseases. It was all around them. Whereas in our society, we think we're in control of death. We think that no matter what goes wrong, somebody will fix it. And we like to hide from death anyway by making everything all nice and whatever. But I was reminded a few days ago, a friend who was diagnosed with throat cancer, and we're not sure he's going to survive or not. And when we saw him, we were talking about it, and I just was aware that when we're not as in control as we think we are, and every now and then we need to be reminded that we are fragile. We're far more fragile than we like to think. So I think it probably applies to our society anyway, that we need to be reminded.
Yes, we no longer have the body of the deceased in our home so that we can wash it and prepare the body for burial. So what effect does that have on us, this distancing of ourselves?
I think we're tempted to value our lives. We don't value life as much if we think it's that we're in control of it. There's a sense that when we are aware that it could end at any time, for me, that urges me to value the minutes and the relationships and the time that we've got in a way that when I lose sight of my mortality, I can just get caught up in it and, not value it.
You know, one thing that has been, in a way, very helpful to me about death is to look at within my own family, my extended family, the way people have dealt with death, especially their interaction with the deceased, and whether they would feel comfortable to, you know, like visit the deceased person in the funeral home, or whether they don't want to. And it's just been so contrasting in my family. Some family members have thought under no circumstances should anybody visit such and such a deceased relative, whereas other people have been very keen to just visit them in the funeral home or have an open coffin at the funeral. And my general observation is that those who want to be sort of more distant from a deceased person, you know, they have much more trouble dealing with the death. You know, they are sort of suppressing, they can't deal with it. Years later, they can barely sort of talk, you know, about the relative that died. Whereas I, myself, I think it's much better just to sort of bite the bullet and, you know, visit the person, even touch them wherever possible. So, yeah, I think our society so suppresses death in many ways. Whereas other societies, they sort of, that's a whole big deal about the deceased person. They will want to visit them. Mm. You know, that's the most important thing, to visit the deceased person.
Mm. Well, we have that movement in our normal division of having a funeral or remembrance and then moving to a wake, where at the wake we allow ourselves to remember the joy of that person and their life and their stories. And there's often laughter and tears at a wake. Yeah, so it's interesting in the psalm, this low part of the psalm leads on to the ability to experience joy, and that perhaps when we make the lows not so low, our highs will not be so high.
I was just thinking, you know, thinking about death and the grass that dies, the image that came to my mind was the scene in the Gladiator movie where Russell Crowe's character is walking down through this field of corn and just touching the corn, and you know, music's just playing gently, and it's kind of his death scene where he's meeting his family who's died before, and it's like that's all that matters in that moment, that none of the other stuff of life matters. And it feels to me like as we get more in touch with going, oh yeah, I'm mortal, none of this matters, that the stuff of life doesn't matter as much. And I say that because I feel like often I'm kind of worried about, you know, like accumulating stuff and having a house and being financially secure and whatever, and that's probably more when I lose sight of my mortality. And when I remember that, it's like all that other stuff is like, okay, well, that's fleeting. Relationships, you know, are important, and everything else doesn't seem to matter as much.
It's interesting that the psalm ends with the focus on work. Establish the work of our hands, Lord. It's a little bit of a strange wording at the end. It's hard to know exactly what that phrase would have meant to the writer. But in a society where we, you know, one of the ways we escape from our having to think about mortality is to bury ourselves in our work, and it can become all-encompassing, whether that work's paid work or some other thing that we devote our hours to. But here it's seen as kind of, we now have freedom to for the work to sit properly. And reading my readings from Ecclesiastes, where he says, well, you know, we're no different from the animals. We all die. The only difference is we know we're going to die. So therefore, you know, the enjoy life and do good work. So this need to work is seen as important, but that somehow our knowing that we are limited and we have limited time enables us to understand where that work belongs. I might be reading too much into what the psalm says there.
Yeah, that sort of leads into something I've just been thinking for the last few minutes. I've noticed that a lot of people, when they have to confront death, so for example, an illness where they may or may not survive, when they do recover, their attitude to their own work changes radically. I remember one friend, and she ditched her job here in Australia and went off teaching children in a poor country. And I've seen that sort of thing happen a lot, where being confronted with death so makes people rethink what they're spending their life on, and will often completely radically change what they're doing in the light of their realisation that they've got limited time. What are they going to do with that limited time? And particularly making money seems to become a little less important, and something else often becomes more important.